Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 10 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. Today is November 30th, and this has been a rather eventful month. If we recap, there's probably could take longer than the audio is it should really last. But following the what many would have described as the unexpectedly wide margin that President Obama won the election in the USA earlier this month, the markets pulled back very sharply as people began to price in a worst-case scenario from the perspective of the fiscal cliff and rising taxes and spending cuts that are due to kick in at the end of December. Following that swift decline, we've had an equally swift rebound, and particularly in Europe. But if we stick with the USA, we've had the S&P rally back above 1,400, and it's closing out this week at 1,416, and the Nasdaq Composite back above 3,000, and the Dow Jones back above 13,000. And that's really been a very positive advance, and it's in no small part on the back of the expectation that some form of compromise will be reached between the Democrats and the Republicans as to what's to be done to at least mitigate part of the implications of $600 billion in revenue-raising measures that are due to kick in January. So we've had some very deep pessimism this month, and we've had a renewed optimism. But until we actually have the detail of what that compromise might be, then the market is likely to be subject to some volatility. And such has been the advance that we've had, that we now are presented with short-term overbought conditions, in which case we could see a little bit of consolidation starting to come in here, particularly on Wall Street. What is particularly interesting is that following the decline earlier this month, Europe in particular has rallied very emphatically. And we have a considerable number of examples of a saying from the chart seminar, which is that if the dynamic of the failure, and it's in relation to failed breaks, if the dynamic of the failure is greater than the dynamic of the breakout, then the chances are that that market is going to go back up and test the other side of the range. And we've seen so many examples of that in Europe, where the FTSE dropped down from its 2 to 3 month range, but rallied right back up and then is now testing the upper side once more. And it's only 140 points away from that 6,000 area, which has been an area of resistance for nearly 2 years. The DAX is right back up to the upper side of its range following a failed downside break earlier in the month. And what we're now starting to see is that an increasing number of markets are actually breaking upwards to new recovery highs following the pullback, and that is most especially the case in Europe and in Asia. In Europe, the Swiss market has pushed on to new high ground, and while it was a little bit weaker in here today, and it's a little bit overbought in the short term, one really would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And a number of European markets are coming off of really quite depressed levels, and they're exhibiting patterns of outperformance. And the Dutch market, and the Austrian market, the Belgian market, and the Swedish market are all examples of that. Where, when we look at Asia, the Thai market hit a new high in here today. The Filipino market continues to extend its overall uptrend. The Indonesian market posted a downside key reversal on Monday and followed through over the last few days, and it's now at the lower side of its range. And this represents the area that if it is going to find support and remain and continue to post this progression of higher reaction lows that has been evident now for quite some time, then this is the area it will find support. And following 18 consecutive days to the downside this month, the Malaysian market has pulled back to an area of previous support and posted an upside, an upward dynamic yesterday, on Wednesday, and has held on to that advance over the last 2 days. In India, we've had some very impressive action this week. And the rupee, which has perhaps been one of the weakest currencies globally and has been trending lower against the US dollar for the last 6 or 7 weeks, posted an upside key reversal this week, suggesting that demand is beginning to return and investor perceptions towards India are improving, and they should be, because we've had a sea change in governance. And whereas one could argue with a high degree of credibility that governance had been deteriorating for much of the last 2 years, the fact that reforms have been pushed through Parliament and the government is still standing is very positive indeed, and it suggests that the dynamic, growth-oriented faction and the of the government is back in the driver's seat. And that market has been led higher by its banking sector. And that has been the case in India for the last few years. And the bank sector is not so far away from its all-time high, and it's leading the market higher. And the Nifty is breaking up out of this range. And there's, when one looks at the last 5 years, there's this rounding characteristic now that is really consistent with accumulation. So India does look like it's in the starting blocks, and it does look like it is going to go higher from here. Then, when we look at China, Yum Brands is perhaps a barometer. And Yum Brands has been emblematic of a company that has succeeded to break into the Chinese market. And it has done so remarkably that its Chinese revenues overtook those of the USA back in 2010. And the share had a very large downside Q reversal in here today. And that was following its results, and it's predicted that it's going to have slowing sales in China in this quarter. And I think the sales are projected to be down about 4%, and the share fell 10% and formed a large downside key reversal both on a daily and a weekly basis. Now, considering the share is trading at a PE of over 20, it can't really afford to miss its sales targets. And it suggests that the share has hit a peak of at least short-term, potentially medium-term significance. And it's right now in the region of the 200-day moving average. But the best-case scenario is that it's going to find support in this area and range and allow some valuation contraction to occur. But such has been the speed with which it's pulled back, the chances are that this is at least a near-term peak. But because it has benefited so much from China, and because the Chinese stock market is so very weak and has been moving to new reaction lows in the last week and over the last month, it does suggest that some of the data that we've been having out of China, where people have been talking about a slowing economy, is feeding through into the consumer base. And it is the health of the consumer on which the Chinese authorities have hung their hopes, because the growth strategy that has been employed over the last 30 years, which has been to depend on low-cost manufacturing and infrastructure development, has, to one extent or another, will need to be replaced by the growth of the consumer. And the reason for that is that standard of living in China has improved out of all bounds in the last 20 years, and the pool of low-cost employment has, to a large extent, evaporated. And what we're now seeing is that a number of other countries are becoming more competitive on extraordinarily low labor costs, and China has no choice but to move up the value chain in terms of its manufacturing and to boost the consumer. And the only way it's going to boost the consumer is if it makes or introduces a greater degree of certainty in people's lives, both from the perspective of healthcare and social security and the environment and employment and housing. And those are the reforms that would have to be pushed through. So while we've seen that over the last 2 years, they've concentrated on attempting to squeeze speculation out of the housing market, and to one extent or another, they have succeeded. But what we're now seeing is that is also having an impact on the consumer base. And while the stock market represents value and is back in an area which has historically been the seedbed for bull markets in terms of valuations, it's in need of a catalyst. And that catalyst is likely to be wide-ranging in terms of policy initiatives to support the consumer. Because if China can succeed in animating the almost $3 trillion in private sector savings, not to mention its public sector savings, but its private sector savings, then it will be able to continue on its remarkable evolution. But that does remain the linchpin, and it will have to succeed in that regard. And that does beg the question, if the consumer is now starting to feel the pain and beginning to affect spending decisions, what is the likelihood that the policy of tightening will be maintained? And doesn't it suggest that we are closer to the next round of monetary easing? And while that is unlikely to be pushed back into infrastructure development, the chances are that any form of stimulus will be pointed directly at the consumer. And it is those sectors that are likely to be the real concentration for efforts in future. So whereas China at present does not offer the same type of encouragement that the pattern that we see in India does, there is significant potential for improvement. And if we do see policy improvement, then we'll almost certainly see stock market improvement. And when we look at the rest of Asia, there is the macroeconomics are improving and the stock market performance is incredibly impressive. But what we're seeing, regardless of which market, it is that when something becomes overextended relative to a trend mean, it becomes increasingly likely that it is going to revert towards that mean. And when it has reverted to the mean and finds support, that has generally been the risk-adjusted entry point from the perspective of a trend-running philosophy. And it is interesting that when one looks at the autonomies, that the process of mean reversion that has been evident for much of the last couple of months appears to be in the process of having run its course. And an increasing number have found support in the region of their 200-day moving averages. And even those that had dropped below them, an increasing number have begun to find support and are pushing back above them. And a good example of that is Starbucks. When we look at the technology sector, the shares for Intel and Microsoft have pulled back remarkably sharply over the last month, and Intel in particular. And I think that was earlier in the month, it was because it was projecting that its sales were going to be lower than anticipated by many. But it has now returned to a potential area of support, and it has at least steadied over the last week. And if we get an upward dynamic, it would suggest that demand and short covering are setting in, because it has been down now on consecutive weeks. So it does represent a rather interesting position at present. This has been an interesting month in the precious metals. And gold in particular it was weak earlier in the month, and we've had a good rally, and we're back above $1,700, and although the market finished down 10 in here today, the chances are, and certainly the balance of probabilities is, that gold is back in the accumulation phase of what has already been a 14-month consolidation. And that, provided it continues to hold its progression of higher reaction lows that have been evident since May, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, and the chances are that we're going to see new highs by sometime next year. And when we look back over the last decade, gold has been prone to accelerations. And when it has become wildly overextended relative to the trend mean, it pulls back, and it generally pulls back remarkably sharply. And that gives way to a lengthy consolidation. And when it eventually breaks out, and at the chart seminar we say that that every trading range congestion area is an explosion waiting to happen, and one of gold's characteristics is that when it does break out, it really runs. And considering the fact that it's been ranging now for 14 months, the chances are that when it does break out, it is going to break out emphatically, and it is going to accelerate away from this lengthy consolidation. And when we look at the other precious metals, we've had a very impressive rally in palladium in particular over the last couple of weeks. And it is a little bit overbought in the very short term. And silver, which has been quite volatile, was down 93 cents in here today, but continues to hold above the 33 area. And platinum, which was as high as 1615 in here today, finished out the day at 1603, and continues to range around that area, and will need to push up successfully out of this trading range and hold the breakout to really demonstrate that demand is back in the driver's seat. And the US dollar has been reasonably steady against major currencies, but the Asian dollar index broke upwards out of an almost, well, I think just over a year long range in here this week. And it is the Asian currencies that are truly strong, whereas elsewhere we've seen quite a degree of variability in performance of currencies. And particularly the Brazilian real is worthy of mention, because the real doubled between, I think, about 2003 and 2008. And that was a remarkable period, both in terms of the improvement that we saw in Brazil's macroeconomics and for the performance of its stock market, and the currency doubling. But that trend has ended, and now the real is trending lower, and it has moved from approximately 150 to 225 in the last year, and it does look like it is going to get weaker from here. And that weakness has corresponded with a generally ranging performance in the stock market. And when we contrast that currency performance with the performance of the Singapore dollar or the Philippine peso, then we can see that, particularly with Asia, when we see that on aggregate the currencies tend to be outperforming, then that has generally transformed into increasing interest in the stock market, because foreign investors see an appreciating currency and an appreciating stock market, and they get a double bang for their buck. And that is certainly part of the motivation behind what we're seeing in the ASEAN region in particular. And ASEAN has many of the advantages today that China would have had more than a decade ago, where there is a pool of cheap labor, and where macroeconomics and the governance situation is improving, and where countries have low debt and rising living standards and a nascent middle class, and demand for basic consumer goods and middle-income goods and cars and luxury goods continues to trend higher. And it is that demand and that growth which is helping to support the outperformance of the autonomy sector. So while the majority of people have been concentrating on China over the last decade, China is but one country, and while it is a high population country, there are other high population countries and there are other high growth countries. India certainly is an attractive proposition from the high population standpoint, and high growth is evident right across the Asian region. But what we are now living in is the greatest urbanization in history. And demand for just about everything that we take for granted in our daily lives is increasing. And that is helping to drive demand from consumer goods, because the world moved from being mostly rural to mostly urban in the last couple of years. And this is the true golden age of humanity, because there are likely to be more people alive at any one time in the next 30 years than ever before, and probably ever again. And as long as that remains the case, we're going to remain on a growth trajectory. And while we have this massive debt mountain, particularly in the West, it is a regional problem rather than a global problem. And most particularly, not only do we have a rising population globally, but an increasing number of people can actually afford to buy the goods to help improve their standards of living. And that is what's helping to drive the bull market in the autonomies. And there's been a great deal of talk about the bond bubble over the last couple of weeks. And it's worth putting it in perspective, because the amount of debt has ballooned in the last 5 years, not least because governments have felt the need to socialize a huge amount of public debt. And while the consumer has improved its balance sheet, particularly in the US, and corporations have improved their balance sheets out of all sight, governments have particularly weak balance sheets. And we're at record low yields. And part of the reason that the Fed's balance sheet and the ECB's balance sheet and the Bank of Japan and the Swiss National Bank and the Bank of England and indeed the ECB have felt the need to absorb so much debt is because the velocity of money has been trending lower for a decade. And central banking 101 is to ensure that there is enough of money in the system to promote growth. And because the velocity of money has been deteriorating, people have been able to argue credibly that we're in a deflationary type scenario. And until that velocity of money starts to pick up, and until there's evidence that there is sustainability in that pickup, then we can anticipate that central banks will continue to increase their holdings of government debt. And it is for that reason that the Fed has left its quantitative easing pretty much open-ended. And with Germany currently flirting with a recession, the ECB is going to be very loose with its monetary policy. And the European version of the TED spread is currently at 10 basis points. So there is massive liquidity flowing through to the banking system, and they are literally being bailed out via the yield curve. So there is going to be no shortage of liquidity. And the massive amount of bonds that are being issued and gobbled up by the various central banks are unlikely to result in inflation until the velocity of money starts to pick back up. And then central banks are going to have to move swiftly to remove the liquidity from the system. And if they fail, we are going to have inflation, and that is going to push up rates. But even in a benign environment, where the velocity of money picks back up and growth moves onto a more sustainable footing, then a higher interest rate would be appropriate, and central banks will raise interest rates. And even in that scenario, what kind of value will be put on the massive amounts of debt that have been issued at very low coupons and very low yields when interest rates start to push back up? And because bonds are a total return instrument, and because you do get these big steps in price charts because of coupon changes and contract changes and backwardations and contangos, then the total return chart, in my opinion, is the best way to monitor the market from an investment perspective. And it represents probably the most consistent chart there is over the last 30 years. And it's held above its 200-day moving average for almost the entire time, and it has one range above another for at least the last decade, probably the last 2 decades, and it continues to trend higher, and it remains above its 200-day moving average. And as long as it's doing that, and a consistent trend is a trend in motion, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But when it stops, and when that index falls below its 200-day MA and sustains that decline, then the bubble will have burst. And we can have long academic arguments about whether it is a bubble at present, or whether how big a bubble it is, or what characteristics there might be. And I could argue until the cows come home that it is a bubble. But whether it is a bubble or not is irrelevant until it bursts. And that means that we can anticipate until it bursts, there will be additional liquidity infusions. And the volatile nature of markets that we have come to live with, and where the banality of risk on, risk off has become an everyday phrase, is likely to continue until we start to see some of that liquidity being taken out of the system and regulatory reform taking place to inhibit the proliferation of high-frequency trading. And that leaves us at an interesting juncture, because we've had a decline and we've had a rebound, and we have a short-term overbought condition at present on some markets, and there's a strong likelihood that we're going to see some additional volatility over the next month. So there are risks in the short term, and there are opportunities in the medium term, but there is extraordinary potential over the long term, because Wall Street has been going sideways now for 12 years, and we're still trending higher, and provided it continues to hold its progression of higher reaction lows over the last 3 and a bit years, then we can anticipate that it will push on to new recovery highs and potentially even get back up and test the upper side of its range. And whether it can break out or not will be a question for perhaps sometime next year or the year after. But when it does eventually break out, the biggest bear markets give way to the biggest bull markets. And the chances are that when it does eventually complete this lengthy consolidation, and it is interesting that the last one was between 1966 and 1981, so 15 years, and this one has been 12 years, so we could be in for another 3 years of ranging. But when it is eventually completed, we'll be into another secular bull market, and it'll likely be even bigger than the last one, and that will be another golden age for equities. But in the meantime, this is a volatile environment, and it's a trader's environment where one is best grabbing profits when something becomes overextended, and potentially buying back when it begins to demonstrate that it's finding support back in the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I wish you all the best to all of you.